We're going to be in Acts 27 this morning, but before we get there, turn with me to 2 Corinthians chapter 11. You guys, I'm preaching in the choir. You all know this, but people listen to the tape, so I'm going to say it for their benefit. If you came into your Christian walk thinking everything was going to be easy, that once you became a Christian, the Lord had this little white puffy cloud for you to sit on and motor around, you know, the rest of life, you're wrong. And this chapter illustrates what Paul went through and what Paul had to suffer. You know, we followed Paul along and we've seen he's been beaten and left for dead, dragged out of cities, you know, passed out of city walls through baskets and sat in prison and had, you know, an army escort so he wouldn't be ambushed. And, you know, he suffered all these things, you know, but here is a detailed trip that he takes and just the things that he had to suffer along this trip. And the Lord had spoken to Paul back when he was in prison in Jerusalem and said, Paul, just as you've been a faithful witness to me here in Jerusalem, you're going to be a faithful witness in Rome. And so Paul had going into this whole ordeal the knowledge from the Lord that he was going to go to Rome. And yet the trip was not the way that he would have hoped it would have been. You know, it was a rough trip. They were all in danger of their life. And it didn't quite go the way Paul would have liked it, you know. He would have liked to have had that army escort all the way up, you know, and been taken care of royally. But it didn't happen that way. In 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 23, Paul had written this probably 4 or 5 years before the events of Acts chapter 27. So Paul has already been through all kinds of trials and tribulations and sufferings for the sake of Christ. In fact, in Acts chapter 9, when Paul gets converted and the Lord sends Ananias over to Paul in Damascus and says, go pray for this guy. He's a chosen vessel. I'm going to send him to the Gentiles and I'm going to show him all that he has to suffer for my name's sake. So Paul, going into his walk with the Lord and following Jesus, knew right off the bat that it would mean suffering and pain. But you know, the Lord is gracious. He doesn't tell us everything, you know. Otherwise, we'd all run the other way for the most part, you know. He just kind of gives there's going to be a little bit of a rough road here, you know, and it's not until you're in the middle of the road and you got no choice to turn him back, you know, that you see the full extent of what's coming, you know. But as we've looked at several times before, God has, in a Christian's life, God has a plan and a purpose for the pain, the tribulation, the suffering, the persecution. And we don't always understand or know what that plan is. And we may never know on the side of eternity what it may be. Sometimes we do. Sometimes the Lord just needs to get our attention, you know, and gets us in a position where we got to go back and get on our knees again because we haven't been there for a while, you know. Or other times it's for someone else's sake. You know, there's been times just in my ministry here at the church where the Lord has brought opportunities here that I've had to deal with, or people and situations that I've had. And not too long after that, that same situation happens in another church. And normally what they do is they call Calvary Philly, and what Calvary Philly will say is, call Bill. He just went through that, you know. And so there's been opportunities where I've had to go through things that have been, you know, and I've directly known, okay, this is why I had to deal with this, because the Lord's got me to, you know, kind of give them some direction and guidance through this. You know, so sometimes we know immediately why we're going through something. Other times we just don't know. But we've got to trust in the Lord's faithfulness to us, his love for us, you know. We got to trust in the scriptures where it does say all things work together. Paul says, for we know that all things work together for good to those who love God and are called according to his purpose. And so sometimes we just got to blindly trust. Lord, I don't understand why, but I've just got to trust you. And that was kind of the situation Paul found himself here. You know, there are times when the Lord takes things out of what little control we have of things, you know, and takes everything out of our control so that we need to trust. And it's in those times of peril, it's in those times of tribulation and all, if we allow the Lord to do his work, that we actually draw closer to him, and it takes us into a deeper relationship. And it gives the Lord an opportunity to reveal himself in ways that he wouldn't if everything always went well, you know. But when we got to be on our knees, when we're crying out to the Lord, when he's got to appear to us in some fashion, way, or form, whether it's through the scripture or through a brother or a sister or, you know, some other way, you know, he takes us into a deeper relationship. And hopefully the next trial and tribulation that we go through, we'll be able to draw on that past experience and see, you know, the Lord got me through that. He can get me through this. You know, so again, we don't always understand why, you know, but he's got his plan and his purpose, and we've just got to trust that he knows better than we do when we go through these things. So here, a couple of years before Paul faces what he's got in chapter 27 here, he writes to the Corinthians, and what has kind of taken place is some false apostles have come into Corinth, and they've been disparaging Paul. You know, if God really loved this guy, why does he have to suffer the way he does, you know? And that's a question that comes up a lot in the Christian life. If God really loves me, why would he do this to me? You know? Well, he's got, again, his plan and his purpose. And he never promised things would be easy. You know? In fact, he promises in his word that there will be trials, there will be tribulation, there will be persecutions. You know? But that's a common question. Well, if God really loved me, why would this happen? Why would I have to suffer? You know, does God treat his kids this way? You know, that kind of thing. And that was kind of the approach that these false teachers were coming and giving the Corinthians. So Paul's going to defend himself. He says, are they ministers of Christ? He says, I speak as a fool. He says, I am more. If they think they're ministers of Christ, well, I'm even more a minister of Christ. In labors more abundant, in stripes above measure, in prisons more frequently, in deaths often. You know, he had a threat of death on his life all the time. From the Jews 5 times I received 40 stripes minus one. Now, most of this we don't see in the book of Acts. This is stuff that Luke didn't record. You know, this was other things that Paul kind of gives us some information on here. So 5 times I got beaten by the Jews, 39 stripes. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. We don't have any other shipwrecks other than this one. And this one happened after the 3 he talks about here. A night and a day I've been in the deep. In journeys often, in perils in waters, in perils of robbers, in perils of my own countrymen, in perils of the Gentiles, in perils of the city, in perils of the in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren. Now, if you were going to hang out with Paul, hang loose. In weariness, in toil, in sleeplessness often, in hunger and thirst, in fastings often, in cold and nakedness. And besides the other things, what comes upon me daily, my deep concern for all the churches. He says, besides all the physical things I went through, he says, I got the spiritual concern for the churches. Corinth was one of them. He was really concerned about Corinth because they were going in the wrong direction, you know. That all weighed on him spiritually, weighed on his heart, you know. So all these other things. So when Ananias said to Paul, you're going to suffer some things, Paul. Paul probably had no clue that this was going to be what it was, you know. But that's what he went through for the name of Jesus. And so we go back to Acts 27. Here in Acts 27, Paul is going to sail under Roman guard to Rome. And it's a very detailed account as Luke traces almost every port, every situation, every wind current, all that went on, as we'll follow the map there. Sir William Ramsay, who was an expert as he researched and did archaeological work and all through the Mediterranean Sea and became an expert in New Testament history, writes this. This narrative of the voyage and shipwreck have been almost universally recognized as the most vivid and trustworthy account of ancient seamanship that has been preserved, one that could only have been given by an eyewitness and a faithful and accurate observer. And so he says chapter 27 here is the most accurate ancient account of a voyage of a ship in ancient history. And he said it can only be done by someone who observed. I'll give a little bit of a hint, but in the video that we're going to watch in a couple of weeks, someone actually did a computer model following the wind currents and all that Luke records and says, yep, the pattern of the ship and everything that would have taken place and where it landed and all is exactly as the model says it would be with all these wind currents and all. So this is an accurate account of what took place. Luke did not embellish. This is for real. So here we go. Verse 1, chapter 27. Of course, Paul has been sitting in Caesarea for a couple of years. He sat before Felix, first of all, accused of the Jews in Jerusalem. Felix says, I don't have anything against this guy, you know, but he wouldn't release Paul because he wanted to make good with the Jews. And then he gets moved out of office, sent back to Rome. And Felix comes in as the Roman governor. He hears Paul. He hears the accusers. He can't find anything. He wants to send Paul back to Jerusalem. And Paul says, I'm not going to Jerusalem. I'm a Roman citizen. I have appeals rights. I appeal to Caesar. You're not sending me back there, because he knew it was death back there. They were waiting for him to ambush him. Guys had been starving themselves for 2 years, waiting to get back, you know, waiting for an opportunity to kill Paul. He knew that was not the route, you know. So he appeals to Caesar. Now Felix has to send him to Caesar, even though he finds nothing wrong with him. But just to keep peace with the Jews, he keeps Paul in prison there in Caesarea also, until Herod Agrippa comes down. And he hears Paul. He can't find anything wrong with Paul. So Paul is being held unjustly just because these guys, these Roman politicians, didn't want to make ways with the Jews. You know, so not a lot has changed in politics, unfortunately. And so now Paul has appealed to Caesar. Felix has a group of prisoners now that he's going to ship off to Rome. Paul is probably the only one that has appealed. The other guys are probably prisoners that have been convicted, and they're being sent to Rome to be put in the Colosseum, to be used as gladiators and to face the lions and to be sport for the Roman citizens there in Rome. Because Paul's the one that finds favor here with this Roman centurion that he's traveling with. And so, verse 1 of chapter 27. And when it was decided that we should sail to Italy, they delivered Paul and some other prisoners to one named Julius, the centurion of the Augustan regiment. Being of the Augustan regiment meant he was one of Caesar's top guys. He was the elite, and his forces would have been the elite. And so they're transporting prisoners here from Caesarea. And so Paul is traveling with one of the top centurions in the entire empire. You know, these guys were no nonsense. If a prisoner escaped, it meant death to the one who was watching him. You know, so these guys meant business. And so Paul was being sent with them. Now, just to get an idea, this timeline is kind of not explicit. It's kind of implied throughout this whole thing. They're probably traveling sometime between August and March or April. So this is about an 8 or 9 month trip that they're taking. It was not preferred to travel east to west in the Mediterranean during the fall and winter months. You normally wanted to be traveling the other way if you were going to travel, because the winds came from west to east. So you had westerly winds. And so for them to go the other direction was sort of hazardous. But to timely get these guys up to Rome, they're going to travel on a grain ship. And so the grain they wanted to get to Rome so they could sell the grain in Rome and make their money and all. They're traveling in that direction for that purpose. And so this was not the ideal time to be going east to west. So they get on the trip. There's other prisoners. They're being watched by Julius, the Augustan regiment. He probably had 100 soldiers with him, because he was a centurion. He watched 100 men. And so entering the ship of Adramyttium, we put to sea, and that was a port near Caesarea, meaning to sail along the coast of Asia. At that time of year, because the winds in the Mediterranean were blowing west to east, the easiest way to travel would have been sticking close to the coast and trying to catch a coastal current or something that would move you west. So they tried to stay out of the Mediterranean as much as possible and just coast hop up to the ports. So they're meaning to go along the coast of Asia. And Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, was with us. He was one of Paul's companions. The next day we landed in Sidon. So they leave Caesarea, take a day trip up to Sidon, land there. Now, Sidon is near Tyre. If you know your Old Testament history, it's always connecting Tyre and Sidon together. They were Phoenician cities, and they were seaports. And they were close by. And when Paul was traveling down to Jerusalem, if you remember, he stopped in Tyre and spent about a week there and fellowshiped with other believers. And so he's got some friends up in this area, and so they land in Sidon, so he meets up with other believers there. And along this trip, it's interesting, Julius, and he must have been briefed by Festus, that this guy's a prisoner, he's appealed to Caesar, but we don't really have anything against him. You know, all the accusations have been given to us, you know, they've been found false or there's no evidence. And so all along the way, the centurion gives Paul a lot of leeway. He doesn't treat him like a normal prisoner, you know. So him and Paul develop an interesting relationship on this trip. And so the next day we landed in Sidon. And Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him liberty to go to his friends and receive care. Now he's a prisoner. Paul, just come back when it's time, you know. So Paul goes into town, you know, and spends some time with other believers and goes to his friends and he receives care. So Paul is, you know, getting candy bars and cookies and whatever else, you know, for the journey, you know. And when we had put to sea from there, we sailed under the shelter of Cyprus because the winds were contrary. Cyprus was this island here in the Mediterranean, so they didn't sail out this way because the winds were blowing the wrong way. So they kept to the coastal side of Cyprus and went up the coast here because the winds were against them. And when we had sailed over the sea, which is off Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra, a city of Lycia. And so they've come up the coast, Antioch, Tarsus probably, and here in Myra is where they settle next. And they've probably been sailing on a small vessel at this point, kind of a coast hopper, you know, not one that's able to go out into the ocean. You know, if you look at the different harbors down on the shore, you know, you see these small fishing boats, and they can only go out maybe a mile, 2 miles, or whatever. And then you get the real big ones, you know, that are seaworthy. You know, so they've been staying on a smaller boat that can hop the coastline here. So now they get to Myra. And the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing to Italy and he put us on board. This would have been a grain ship. This would have been the largest type of ship that would have traveled the Mediterranean. It would have had one main mast in the middle with a sail. And there's actually 276 people aboard. So pretty large ship. They've got a whole load of grain. They've got 276 passengers. So he finds a ship that's going to Italy. This was not, again, the opportune time to be sailing. For some reason, this guy, you know, the owner of the ship or the ship captain, got there late. They're trying to get to Italy to make their sale and not lose their profits for the year. So the centurion finds this ship, and he puts us on board. When we sailed slowly many days, we arrived with difficulty off Cnidus, and the wind not permitting us to proceed. So they leave Myra here, they sail along the coast, and end up in Cnidus. Now, normally, a ship going east to west from here would sail across the Aegean Sea into Greece and then sail from there to Italy. But the winds are blowing in the opposite direction, so it's hard to get across there. And so what their plan is it said, the wind not permitting us to proceed, we sailed under the shelter of Crete to Salamone. There's this time of the year, there would be also a north wind which would blow down, so they found it easier, instead of sailing this way, to sail down under Crete and use Crete kind of as a shelter against the north wind so they could continue to move west. So that's the direction that they're going. And passing it with difficulty, we came to a place called Fair Havens near the city of Lycia. So Fair Havens is this little port here. So they finally get down to there. It's probably getting late in the year, maybe late autumn. And the rest of the trip, they know, is going to be tough. Now, when we had spent much time there, and sailing was now dangerous because the fast was already over. The fast would have been the Day of Atonement and the Feast of Tabernacles for the Jews. And that would have been late September, early October. And so, you know, it's already passed. So now they're moved into the middle of fall. And the winds and the seas are going to get treacherous for just a sailing vessel like this. So it says that sailing was now dangerous because of the fast was already over. Paul advised them, saying, "Men, I perceive that this voyage will end with disaster and much loss, not only of the cargo and ship, but also of our lives." That's kind of interesting. It seems to me that somewhere along this ship, as things got a little more turbulent and a little tougher and a little more dangerous, Paul even started to doubt. Because he had been told by the Lord when he was in prison, "You're going to Rome." But here he says, "I perceive that if we keep along, you know, the way we're going, you're not only going to lose the ship, and you're not going to lose the cargo, we're all going to die." You know? He's not saying, "You're all going to die." He said, "We're all going to die." You know? "We'll all lose our lives," is what he's saying here. So it seems like here, you know, and that's kind of comforting because, you know, sometimes we get in the middle of our trials and tribulations, we start doubting, you know? And we think, "Oh man, you know, I'll never get out of this. You know, this is the end. You know, there's no hope left here," you know? And so Paul had that same sense here. You know, if we don't change something here, guys, if you don't stop the course you're going on, we're all going to die, you know? And so he goes and he tells him this. "Nevertheless, the centurion was more persuaded by the helmsman," he would have been the captain, "and the owner of the ship, than by the things spoken by Paul," which would make sense from a natural standpoint because they're the sea captains. You know, they're the ones that sail back and forth here. You know, they know the seas. This is their job. Paul's a preacher, you know. So Am I going to listen to a preacher or am I going to listen to the professionals? You know, so he listens to the professionals and says, let's keep going. It says, and because the harbor was not suitable to winter in, the majority advised to set sail from there also, if by any means they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete opening towards the southwest and northwest, and winter there. Now, they're in this little harbor called Fair Havens, and they're looking around going, we don't really want to stay the winter here. There's nothing to do here. You know, no movie theaters, no, for these guys, no bars, you know, and we're going to be bored to death if we stay here in Fair Havens. So let's try and get to the next port because there's more stuff going on there. There's better nightlife, better accommodations, you know. And so if we got to winter someplace, let's winter there, you know. And so they decided, well, let's move on. And so they leave. They leave Fair Havens here, and they're only trying to get up here to Phoenix, which is, you know, just a couple ports away. However, the weather had a different idea. You know, and these guys, they don't have motors on their ships. You know, today, you got sailboats that have motors, you know. So if you can't get there by the wind, you pull the sail down, you turn the motor on, you go where you want to go. You know, these guys had to follow the winds. And so if the wind and the current wasn't going in the right direction, you just had to go with the current, you know. So that's kind of the situation they're in here. So when the south wind blew softly, supposing that they had obtained their desire, putting out to sea, they sailed close to Crete. Now, as you're reading this, when they talk about the different wind directions, they always talk about the direction the wind is coming from. So an easterly is blowing east to west. A southerly wind is blowing south to north. Northerly is blowing north to south. And so the normal winds at this time of year are blowing west to east, so they would be westerly winds. They catch, when they're getting ready to leave the port here, a southerly wind, which would have pushed them north, which is the way they wanted to go. So when they set out, looked like everything was going to work out to their plans. They'd be able to reach Phoenix with no problem. So when the south wind blew softly, supposing that they had obtained their desire, putting out to sea, they sailed close by Crete. But not long after, it didn't take long for them to get out to sea, that a tempestuous headwind arose called a Euroclydon. So when the ship was caught and could not head into the wind, we let her drive. So when they started out in this direction, all of a sudden they caught another headwind coming in this direction, and it blew them. Now, this map isn't quite accurate here because we'll find that they're worried about running into some quicksand and some shallow stuff over here. So they're actually being blown further south, according to the scriptures here. So once the headwind caught them, he said they let it go. They just let it drive. And running under the shelter of the island called Claudia, we secured the skiff with difficulty. They would have had a small boat that they would have towed. And so that if they were landing in a port that had a shallow port and they wanted to get off, they could jump in the small boat, row to shore, and then come back out again. Okay, so it's getting too rough. They're afraid of losing it. And so they secure it and probably bring it on board. And it said, we secured the skiff with difficulty. So the waves and the wind was so tough now that they had trouble getting the small boat on board. When they had taken it on board, they used cables to undergird the ship. So they actually run cables under the ship so it wouldn't fall apart if the storms got too severe. So this is getting serious. And fearing lest they should run aground on the citrus sands, they struck sail and so were driven. So again, you know, they leave here. Their intention was just to go up to Phoenix, but they're finding themselves being blown down into this direction. And down here, there was, you know, sand and there was probably no ports down here, but a lot of sand that they could get stuck in. So they were worried about being blown down there. So they actually take the sails down, and they're just kind of going with the currents at this point, hoping not to get blown south. And because we were exceedingly tempest-tossed, the next day they lightened the ship. So now they're starting to throw things overboard. It's getting really rough. On the third day, we threw over the ship's tackle with our own hands. So Paul's helping them, and they're throwing everything that's loose, all the ship's tackle and everything else overboard, all the chains, all the heavy stuff that they're carrying on board. Now, when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest beat on us, which means a large tempest was beating on them, all hope that we would be saved was finally given up. Even Paul. Luke is writing, we just gave up. We hadn't seen the sun. So if they hadn't seen the sun, that means they hadn't seen the stars. And that's the way they navigated. You know, they navigated by the sun and the stars. So now it's been many days and they haven't seen the sun. They haven't seen the stars. They have no idea where they're going. They're just out there drifting. You know, they got no idea what's happening. And no small tempest, which means this big tempest was beating on the ship. And they're at the point now where they're giving up. But after a long abstinence from food, Paul stood in the midst of them and said, "Men, you should have listened to me." Way to go, Paul. I told you so. "You should have listened to me and not have sailed from Crete and incurred this disaster and loss. Now I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For there stood by me this night an angel of the God whom I belong to and whom I serve, saying, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must be brought before Caesar. And indeed, God has granted you all those who sail with you.'" So that gives you an indication that Paul had lost heart. Paul had given up too. And the Lord had to send an angel to him and said, "Paul, remember what the Lord told you back in prison? You will get to Rome. It was a promise that was made to you. God doesn't go back on his promises, regardless of what kind of circumstances we're in. He doesn't go back on his promises. He said you're going to Rome. He says, not only that, but everyone that is with you is going to get there with you. You know? So don't lose heart. I had a situation one time. This reminded me of something that happened way back in high school. We had played, I was on the high school baseball team, and we had played a game, and I don't remember where it was. It wasn't Council. It must have been William Tanner or someplace up in Warminster. And we're coming home, and the bus was taking Bridgetown Pike, I think it is. I don't know, Brownsville Road. I forget which it is, but it's a real hilly road that runs into Langhorne just before the high school. And, I mean, really up and down. We used to love it when we were kids because my dad would speed over the, you know, and you get that. And faster, Dad, faster, you know. And we're driving, and the bus driver is driving the bus, and we notice the bus is picking up speed. And at first we thought the guy was messing around, you know, let's jump over the bumps real cool, you know. Then it got kind of scary, you know. So the coach leans over to him and says, "What's the matter?" He says, "I have no brakes." Right? So we're probably doing like 65, and he can't stop the bus, right? The kid leaning in front of me, our center fielder, everybody on the team knew I was a Christian. I had had an opportunity actually to share the Lord in front of a whole assembly one time in high school. And back then, we had the Christian Motorcycle Club, and I would take my motorcycle to school, and we would have the Christian Wheels colors on my back and all. So everybody knew who I was, you know. It was no doubt, you know. He leans over the seat, and he says, "Bill, start praying." And I said, "Bob, I've been praying." Well, we got no brakes the whole way. We just, you know, up and down, you know, and we coasted into the parking lot of the school, you know. And, of course, everybody cheers for the bus driver. Bob leans over the seat and says, thank you. Well, thank me. I didn't do it, you know. He went on to be an NFL pro, all-pro punter for the Kansas City Chiefs, you know, by the way. But just a side thing. And but I was just, as I was reading this, I just remembered, you know, him leaning back and said, Bill, please pray. I'm praying, Bob. The Lord's got us in his hands. So Paul says, take heart, men, for I believe God that it will be just as it was told to me. However, we must run aground on a certain island. So now Paul kind of takes over the ship. The pros haven't done so good. You know, everything is kind of panned out the way Paul said it was. So now the centurion's looking at the pros going, you didn't do so good. I'm listening to this guy. You know, and so from here on out, they're going to listen to Paul. So he tells me they got to run aground on a certain island. And they had no idea where they are. You know, they're just blowing across the sea, you know, so they don't know where they're going to end up at this point. Now, when the 14th night had come, as we were driven up and down the Adriatic Sea. And so the Adriatic Sea is up here. So you can kind of see the way the boat's been going. Up and down over those hills that I was riding on. About midnight, the sailors sensed that they were drawing near some land. So something must have changed. There's no light. There's no stars. They're just being tossed around. But something changed, and they sensed that they were getting near some land. And they took soundings and found it to be 20 fathoms. 20 fathoms. A fathom is equal to 6 feet. And so they took some soundings, they dropped their ropes with their markings on it, and found that they were 120 feet deep. So that gave them a sense that they're getting closer to land. They went a little further, dropped it again, and found that it was 15 fathoms, which was 90 feet deep. Then, fearing lest we should run aground on the rocks, they dropped 4 anchors from the stern. The stern is the back of the boat. And noticed, and they all prayed for day to come. Now they're still pagans, but now they've figured, okay, let's pray, you know. And so now they're all praying, please send us day before we get wrecked here on the rocks, you know. And so they've dropped anchors, 4 of them, and they're praying for day. And as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship, when they had let down the skiff into the sea, under pretense of putting out anchors from the prow, was the front of the boat, Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved. We got to all stay together. A couple of the soldiers said, you know what, let's get the boat, the little boat out of here and paddle to shore, you know, at least save ourselves. Paul goes to the centurion and says, you got some guys who are trying to get out of here, you know, on the little skiff. If they do that, we're all going to die. We got to stay together here. And so the centurion sends soldiers, and they cut the ropes from the skiff and let it fall so none of the soldiers could get on it. So off it goes and probably gets wrecked on the rocks. And as day was about to dawn, Paul implored them all to take food, saying, today is the 14th day. You have waited and continued without food and eaten nothing. So for 14 days, these guys, and there's probably a lot of them are seasick, you know, and you don't want to eat at that point, you know. And so these guys have been without food and drink for 14 days. A lot of it, maybe they even threw overboard, you know, and there wasn't enough to ration between all of them for the whole trip, you know. But he says, take food. You're going to need it. You're going to need the strength. Therefore, I urge you to take nourishment, for this is for your survival, since not a hair will fall from your head, from the head of any of you. And when he had said these things, he took bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of all of them. It's amazing how much you can get away with when people are in danger. You know, down when Katrina hit down in New Orleans and all, and they were sending groups down from the different calvaries and all. when they would ask, you know, can I pray for you? Yes, please pray for me. You know, it's like, I got nothing else, you know. And so if there's a God out there and he can help me, I'll take it, you know. So Paul now with these pagan soldiers and these prisoners and all, let's pray before we eat. And they go, okay, Paul, whatever you say. So he takes the bread and gives thanks in the presence of them all. And when he had broken it, he began to eat. And they were all encouraged and also took bread for themselves. And in all, we were 276 persons on the ship. So when they'd eaten enough, they lightened the ship and threw out the wheat into the sea. So they ate what they could and they dumped the rest of the cargo over. And, you know, it's kind of interesting that in the haste of this ship owner wanting to make his profits before the end of the year, taking risks to do that, he lost it all, you know. And has something to say about commerce, you know, and motivation. And when it was day, they didn't recognize the land. This is a place they had never been before. You know, it wasn't one of their normal seaports. They didn't recognize the lay of the land. But they observed a bay with a beach onto which they planned to run the ship if possible. Then they let go the anchors and left them in the sea. So they cut the anchors loose. They had four of them they had dropped out the back of the ship when they were at about 90 feet. Meanwhile, loosing the rudder ropes, they hoisted the mainsail to the wind and made for shore. But striking a place where two seas met, they ran the ship aground, and the prow stuck fast and remained immovable. So as they were sailing into this bay, there was a place where two seas came together, and it forced the ship to go aground, and so the front of the boat gets stuck, and they can't go any further. The prow stuck fast, verse 41, and remained immovable, but the stern was being broken up by the violence of the waves. So the front stuck, they're in a place where the two seas are coming together, so the back of the boat is being battered, and so it starts falling apart. And it's already been weak from the rest of the storm. You know, they've been out there for a couple months now, you know, and at least the last 14 days they've gotten battered pretty good. And so whatever's left of the strength of the boat is starting to crumble at this point. Verse 42, and the soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners. Again, if a prisoner escaped, it was their lives. So my life or the prisoner's life, I'll kill the prisoner, you know, save my own life. So that was their plan. We'll just kill all the prisoners and save our own skin, lest any of them should swim away and escape. And the centurion, wanting to save Paul, kept them from this purpose and commanded that those who could swim should jump overboard first and get to land. So the centurion says, no, we're not killing any. He wants to save Paul, so we're not killing any of the prisoners, you know. And so he says, you guys who can swim, you jump and start swimming. And the rest, some on boards. Now, the West Coast Calvaries say that this is the invention of surfing. I just, you know, thought I'd point that out. Some went on boards, some on parts of the ship, and so it was that they all escaped safely to land, just as Paul had said they would. And now when they had escaped, they then found out that they were on an island called Malta. So where they end up after all of this is this little island off of Italy called Malta. And that was not normally, you know, in their sea routes. You know, they would have just sailed from Italy to Greece to Asia and then down into the Middle East, you know. So Malta wasn't on their normal sea routes. So they get there, and they didn't know where they were until they found out that they were on this island called Malta. And the natives showed us unusual kindness, for they kindled a fire and made us all welcome because of the rain that was falling and because of the cold. So these guys had just, you know, come out of the sea. The natives are there, and they take them in and show them kindness. They start a fire for them. and trying to get the crew to warm up. And when Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks, you know, Paul had the heart of a servant. A servant looks at a situation and says, something needs to be done. And he doesn't look for someone else to do it. He says, so if it needs to be done and I can handle it, I'll do it. Paul looked around. There's 276 guys here. He had just saved all their skin, rescued all of them. He could have sat back and said, hey, guys, I've done my job. You know, go get wood and bring it in for the fire. But that wasn't Paul's heart. It wasn't Jesus' heart. It shouldn't be our heart. Our heart should be, hey, there's a job to do. I can do it. Let me do it. You know. And so he's out gathering sticks for the fire, seeing that there's a need. They need more sticks. You know, and so he's out gathering sticks. And this is one of those times where you want to go, why me, Lord? I'm out here doing your work. I'm serving you. I'm serving these people. Verse 3, when Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and laid them on the fire, a viper came up out because of the heat and fastened on his hand. So, in the midst of gathering these sticks, he picks up a snake. And you know, if you've ever been in the woods, sometimes you can't tell a snake from a stick. We used to camp up in Little Pine State Park up in the mountains when I was a kid. And there was, I hate snakes. You know, I can't tell one snake from another, so I'm not taking a chance. I see a snake, I'm heading the other direction. And there was a man-made dam at the foot of the hills, and on the other side was the river. And in the morning, I would climb up the dam, and I would have my devotions up on the top of the dam and all. You know, it was kind of cool because you got a couple mountains coming down. You got the lake down there, and you see deer coming down and drinking from the lake and all. And I did that for like 2 years. We went up 3 years when I was a kid. We were talking to one of the forest rangers, and he says, you know, the rattlesnakes come out and sun themselves on the rocks up on the dam. That was the last time I was on the dam, you know. It's like, well, thank you very much. You've ruined my devotional. Now I've got to find another place. But so Paul, you know, snakes like the heat. You know, they hibernate. So he was kind of like dormant until the heat of the fire warmed him up. And then he struck at the first thing he'd find, and it happened to be Paul's hand. You know, and I'm sure Paul's going, you know, there are so many other prisoners here that deserve this, you know. Why me, Lord? So when the natives saw the creature hanging from his hand, they said to one another, no doubt this man is a murderer, you know. He's getting what he deserved. He survived the sea. He survived, you know, everything he's gone through so far, but fate's going to get him, you know. No doubt this man is a murderer, whom though he has escaped the sea, yet justice does not allow him to live. You know, that great overseeing justice in the world, you know. He got his thing, you know. There's a scripture in Mark that says, that you shall take up snakes and they shall not harm you. Now, there have been some groups that have misinterpreted that scripture. And they feel like the Lord is saying to them, if you take up snakes, you can show how much faith you have by handling the snakes. And so there's this whole rattlesnake cult branch off of Christianity. I believe, you know, they're probably sincere Christians, just misguided, you know. When Satan came to the Lord and said, when they were at the pinnacle of the temple, jump off and the angels will catch you, you know, and everybody will see that you're the Messiah because you'll come floating down with these angels around you, you know. It's kind of the idea he was given off there. And the Lord said, you shall not tempt the Lord your God. In other words, don't put yourself in a situation where you're pressing God. You know, I think where that scripture in Mark applies is to a situation like Paul here. If you're out doing the ministry and you run into a situation that's dangerous, get bit by a snake, and I've heard of other mission stories where people have been bitten by poisonous insects and other things and not been harmed. You know, the Lord will take care of you there, but don't put yourself in a position being stupid, you know, and because people have died being bit by rattlesnakes that they've handled in the churches, you know. And so he's not talking about that in Mark, but I think a situation like this, that would apply. Paul wasn't looking to demonstrate his faith here, you know. The snake bit him, and I'm sure he was annoyed. And so they think, okay, this guy's going to die. Fate's finally got him. He's ready to go. But he shook the creature off into the fire and suffered no harm. So the Lord protected him. However, they were expecting that he would swell up or suddenly fall down dead. Now remember, Luke is a physician, you know, so he knows all the things that would happen on a snake bite, you know, so they're all expecting him to swell up and die, fall down dead. After they had looked for a long time, so you see all these natives just watching Paul, you know, and he's still going about his business. You know, he's warming himself by the fire, gathering sticks, you know. He's got his hot dog over the, you know, thing, you know, and they're looking at him going, there's nothing happening to this guy. What's going on here? So after they looked at him and saw no harm had come to him, they changed their minds and said, it's got to be a god. Man is so fickle. It's amazing. So he went from a common murderer to now he's a god. In that region, there was an estate of a leading citizen of the island, whose name was Publius, who received us and entertained us courteously for 3 days. And so this leading citizen, he would have been the governor of the island. He welcomes probably the centurion and the crew, and somehow Paul and, you know, Paul has now become one of the prominent men of this cruise, you know, and so Luke and, you know, all Paul's companions get invited to dinner at this guy's house, you know, this governor's house. And it happened that the father of Publius lay sick of a fever and dysentery, and Paul went into him and prayed, and he laid hands on him and he was healed. And so when this was done, the rest of those on the island who had diseases also came and they were healed. You know, so word gets out. First of all, they think this guy's a god. And then he goes and he heals the governor's father-in-law, or father. And then word gets out that healing's taking place here, you know. So people are starting to gather up and getting healed. So verse 10 says, and they honored us in many ways, and when we departed, they provided such things as were necessary. More than likely, you know, in this whole process, Paul was preaching the gospel and these people were getting saved. You know, Luke doesn't mention that here so much, but Paul never went anything where he didn't give glory to Jesus. You know, he wouldn't have accepted, yeah, I'm a god and, you know, I'm going to do these wonderful things for you, you know. He would have honored Jesus with this, and they would have. But if it hadn't been for this ship going down here and up here and all this, and then shipwrecked here, nobody would have still heard of Malta. The gospel wouldn't have gone there. You know, it was the snake bite that kind of won over everybody's curiosity about Paul. The Lord had a purpose in that whole thing, you know. It wasn't the way Paul had planned to go to Rome. You know, when he was, I figure he was in Corinth or Ephesus during his, I think his second missionary journey, he wrote to the Romans and says, I want to come to Rome and then I want to go to Spain. That's my travel plans, you know. And the Lord said, you're going to Rome, but not the way you think, because I've got other things. You know, and we don't know how many of those prisoners and how many of those centurion and the other passenger or the other soldiers may have gotten saved through this whole ordeal. There's a story that I was sharing with Ed George Whitfield, who was a famous preacher during the late 1600s, early 1700s. And he ministered in England, but then he came to the United States and did a lot of ministry here in the United States. And I was reading his biography, and on one of his trips, he was sailing to the U.S. He had started some orphanages down in Atlanta, and he was sailing to the U.S., and there were three boats sailing together. It was the captain's ship, and then he had two other boats that he was bringing to the U.S. with different passengers and stuff. The sailors, the crew, had found out that Whitfield was a Christian, so during the whole first part of the journey, they're mocking him, making fun of him, you know, and just belittling him for his faith and all. And Whitfield never said a word. All he did was served the crew and the passengers. If they were hungry, he would go get them food. If they were thirsty, he would go get him something to drink. If somebody got seasick, he would take care of them and their seasickness. He just served the whole crew. About a third of the way across the Atlantic, they were scheduled to stop at an island and get some more supplies and all. By the time they got to the island, he had won the respect of everyone on that ship. Because he never said one word about the gospel, but he served. And he earned so much respect that the sea captain said to him, "What I want you to do is every day when the sea is calm," he says, "I'll have a time when we bring all the three ships together and you stand on my deck and you preach the gospel to them." And so for the rest of the voyage, he got an opportunity every time it was calm to preach the gospel on the way over. You know, all he did was serve. And so they watched Paul's life. They observed Paul, you know, and it opened up all kinds of opportunities for the Lord to minister. You know, the gospel went forth in this island of Malta, right from the governor's palace. You know, and if God hadn't done all those things that Paul did not have in his travel plans, you know, those things would have never been accomplished. God knows so much better than we do. You know, sometimes he just wants us to take the sails down and just go with the flow. Okay, God, where are you taking me today, and what's... What opportunities do you have? You know, Pastor Chuck always said he never looked at things as being interruptions, but as opportunities. You know, if God sent an interruption during the day, it was because he had an opportunity for something else that he was opening up. You know, and so we see through Paul and his just the way he conducted himself through this, and he lost heart. You know, he feared. He thought he was going to die. And the Lord had to remind him too, like he has to remind us. I am with you. I will fulfill my purposes. You know, you'll be okay. Just trust me. You know, so, an amazing journey. Hope none of you are seasick. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for...